Good evening, everybody. My name is Charlie Harari. It's an honor to be able to moderate this wonderful panel tonight. I want to speak just for a minute about what I think is really going on here, why we have this for, and how it relates to social media. And we're going to play a short video, not one of mine, thank you very much, but another video on YouTube. And then we'll turn it over to the esteemed panel behind me. A few years ago, I turned 30. It was a big deal for me. I didn't know what happens when you turn 30. I thought you go, it's like 0 to 30 and 30 till whenever. I didn't know if I should buy dentures or move to Florida or eat prunes. I didn't know. And at that point, I was 6 sizes heavier than I am now. Big. So I think myself, I'm 29 and a half. I'm thinking, I think just at 30, your body just sort of freezes. You can't lose weight after that. You're stuck with the gut for the rest of your life. So I went on this massive diet. I ate nothing, cardboard or whatever, and I worked out all the time. And it was going pretty well. And it was getting more and more and more. I was going to the gym, and after a while, I was spending a lot of time in the gym, and nothing was changing. I had no more definition, just sort of after the first few months, there was nothing doing. Someone suggested, why don't you get a personal trainer? I'm like, I'm not going to get a personal trainer. I played, you know, floppish basketball or whatever. I'm too proud for that. So they said, well, okay. So I'm like, you know what? I'd rather not have any definition than admit a need to get a personal trainer. So it was sometime in May, and one of the things I do for the company is I am in charge of the intern program. So I'm sitting there with a stack of resumes this high, and every single one's going through, you know, this clinic, that clinic, GPA, blah, blah, blah. And I look down on one of them, and the hobbies, it says, personal trainer. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah. I'm going to get my personal trainer. I'm getting my personal trainer. So I call him in first. He's like, I'm like, tell me. So he's like, this clinic, that clinic, I did that extra thing, this extra thing. I'm like, yeah, yeah, you're boring me. Tell me about your personal training experience. So he says, well, what can I tell you? We helped together to train Mr. Universe. I'm like, you're hired. He's like, for the legal intern job? I'm like, yeah, 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 legal intern job. See you on Monday. So he shows up on Monday. I'm like, why are you in a suit for? He's like, I'm doing the legal internship. I'm like, oh, yeah, right. I'm like, what are you doing at 12 o'clock every single day for the rest of the summer? He said, where do you want me? I'm like, see you in the gym at 12 o'clock. It's the best summer of my life. So 12 o'clock shows up. I'm already full at a gym in my building. I'm already full working out. And he comes in, and he goes, okay, show me what you do. I'm like, show you what I do. Well, you see all those machines? I'm like, I do them all. So he's like, all right, tough guy, show me what you do. So I sit down, all of them, I'm so proud. Every machine I go on, I just, you know, sort of pop out as many as I can. And he's literally holding back laughter. And I'm like, what's so funny, Mr. X intern? I didn't know that I was trying to be, you know, humorous. So after it's over, I go, so? He goes, of course you're not seeing any difference. He's like, and I've been working out. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm here 4 days a week. So he goes, you're doing aerobics for like your arms and legs. That's not like working out. I'm like, what does it mean to work out? He goes, here's the rule. If you don't do this rule, you're not working out. So he said, the last 3 reps of what you're doing have to kill. If you're lifting weights and the last 3 don't kill, you're doing aerobics. It's better than eating a hamburger, but you're not doing anything to your arms and your legs. Because the way it works is that your body at a micro level has to tear its fibers. And when you work out and you push the weight, it tears. And then with protein and rest, it builds bigger. And you rip and it builds bigger, and that's how it goes. If you do them too heavy and you can't get 2 or 3 up, you're going to really hurt yourself. If you do them too light, you're not going to work out. You have to do them exactly right. Totally changed. I turned 30 and lo and behold, you don't just have to eat prunes and move to Florida. So thank God I had a few more years. Maybe I don't know what's going on at 40, but so what I learned from that story when I walked away, which is so shocking to me at least, that lesson was that sometimes in life, we go through life and we sort of figure it out, and we're supposed to, but then we have to stop and figure out truth. Because if we don't, either we're just going to go through the motions and not be effective, or we're going to hurt ourselves. This is, in my opinion, what tonight's all about. Social media is what's happening around us. Very rarely can somebody say, I'm going to live my life without a computer if you're under the age of 30. It's not likely. It's not happening. And what's happening, we're going to see a video in a minute as to what's happening on the social media front. It is one of the greatest revolutions possibly since the Industrial Revolution, and it's going to be a part of all of our lives, both in our relationships, in our business, and in our lives. However, the way we approach it has become, I'll just figure it out, right? This feels right, this doesn't feel right, this feels right, this is too much. And we sort of go through the motions. And if we don't know how to use it, we're not going to be effective. But more importantly for tonight, if we don't appreciate the potential dangers in it, we're going to end up hurting ourselves and people around us. And we run the risk of waking up one morning and saying, I can't believe what's lacking in my life because I wasn't cognizant over the social media power. And so that's why we're here tonight. We are equipped with a Rosh Yeshiva, with a doctor of business who understands the marketplace better than most, and with a doctor of psychology who understands the mind better than most. And so what we're going to hear from each of them today, and then I'll post some questions, and then we'll turn around and you guys will post questions, is really what's happening on sort of these three fronts. Hashkafa Halacha, which guides our lives, our business, our careers, our financial future, which guides a lot of our days, and everything else, our minds, our relationships, and how that all plays in. So let's begin. Let's begin on the side of relationships, a side that we all have in our lives currently and are searching for in the future, which is why we have YU Connects. You should be able to search through Dr. Sobolewski and other very important environments like NYU. So I'm going to start with Dr. Palkovitz, who is, the way I call him in Brooklyn, the Mac Daddy, in terms of everything that he says. Whatever he says goes. So let me open up with Dr. Palkovitz to speak about social media and relationships.
I'm going to focus on three points, just as triggers for thought. The first is I'm going to speak about Half Shabbos. Before I speak about Half Shabbos, and I'll explain what that is if any of you don't know, before I speak about Half Shabbos, I'm going to talk about two papers that came out today. One is a position paper by the American Academy of Pediatrics that talks about that the fact that one in five adolescents check their social media site, check Facebook, more than 10 times a day. The vast majority of the population that age is checking it on a regular basis, but there's one in five is checking it constantly, and then they find that those heavy users are at greater risk for depression. So that's one thing that came out. The other thing that's recently come out is something that's being called, I love the name, On Call. Here's what On Call is. It's the finding that four in five adolescents in this country report sleeping with their Blackberries and iPhones next to their beds, always concerned that maybe a call's going to come in. Of that four in five, an alarmingly high percentage sleep with their cell phones under their pillow, just in case. So you may think, okay, this is kind of harmless. But in a recent paper, pediatricians at Children's Hospital in Boston, one of the leading children's hospitals in the country, report a new syndrome that's coming up a lot, which is kids coming in exhausted. They're not getting enough deep sleep. And they're coming in exhausted and with related stress disorders. And then when they try to get to what's underneath it, it's the fact that they're always on call. So you might think, okay, what's so important that they're always on call? So I'm going to quote to you from their own words, So here it is. A Brookline 10th grader sleeps with her cell phone under her pillow so she doesn't miss emergency texts. So as an example of an emergency text, like if a friend broke up with her boyfriend. Then it quotes a 14-year-old who's also available for urgent overnight correspondence, such as, hey, just seeing if you're awake. Okay, that's important to know. Then they quote some other high school kids who get as many as 100 texts while in bed. And if somebody says, I just don't feel myself if I don't have my phone near me. It's a constant state of being on, constant state of being on alert. Some of you may see people who daven Shemona Esrei, okay, with their cell phone, right, you know, at the ready, you know, just in case something important comes in. I mean, they're davening, and I'm sure they have great kavana, but just in case, there's always like a half an eye out for what might be coming in text-wise. Half Shabbos, we had some data that we analyzed just this last week on 1,200 kids going to modern Orthodox Jewish high schools, and we found, and that we think this is already quite antiquated, we found that 1 in 5 in this anonymous survey admitted to texting on Shabbos. 1 in 5. We think it's gotten quite a bit worse in the years since we first gathered the data. We're hearing from various educators and various modern Orthodox yeshivos that it's probably more like 40%. But 1 in 5 are admitting it. Tragic. Tragic. Why is it tragic? And this is the first main point I want to make. The reason it's tragic, and you'll hear more about this soon, is our Bali Musar have been talking for a very long time about Pizur HaNefesh. Pizur HaNefesh is fragmentation of the soul. Fragmentation of the soul is what happens when we multitask, what happens when we're doing many things at once. And when we do many things at once, we don't realize it, but our stress levels go up. Without even realizing it, we're in a state of chronic arousal. And basically, there's not much awareness about what's going on. Rather than show you my slideshow, which I have, but I decided instead to just talk to you guys. This is the one slide I wanted to show you, okay? If you take a look at the slide, the picture on the left, that's the way your brain looks when it's learning Gemara, if you're really concentrating and you're not bottling. That's the way your brain looks when it's reading a book deeply with no interruptions. You're going deep. You're going deep. And you're thinking in a way that doesn't have distractions. You're thinking in a way that is, you don't see the three-dimensional part of this, but it's really going deep in a way that's an art that is getting lost. The picture on the right is the way brain looks when it's reading the same material on the internet. And you're also checking for texts, and you're also checking maybe a hyperlink, and you're also diffusing your attention in different ways. And you first look at that, it looks like, whoa, that brain is much busier than the brain on the left, but it's not. It's a mile wide and an inch deep. Okay, and that's what all the new research is showing, is the kids, their stress levels are going up, their connections are going down, the depth of connection is going down, and cognitively, we're getting a serious drop in writing abilities and deep critical thinking skills. The opposite of Pizur HaNefesh, if you look in the Sifrei Musar, is Menuchas HaNefesh. It's what Shabbos is about. Shabbos is about being, not doing. And we need that. We need that. Psychologists tell us that a core need of an individual is to have a place of stillness, to have a place of being, because that's the way Menuchas HaNefesh comes. I'm not going to go into it, but I have some magnificent quotes going back hundreds of years of what our Chazal tell us about how Shabbos is about shutting out our thinking and our connection to the outside world, and the Menuchas HaNefesh comes with focus on being as opposed to doing. And so the first take-home message I have is just to make you aware of this. It's to make you aware that there's a cost to having this on at all times. There's a cost to having our attention fragmented. There's a cost to having our brains look like that right brain as opposed to like that brain on the left. So that's take-home message number one, is beware of Pizur HaNefesh. Beware of the superficiality that it's about. I'm not saying that we could possibly get rid of it. Like we just saw, we can't get rid of it. Here's a quote that just came out a couple of weeks ago somebody who's talking about just the massive change in the last 2 years. In the last 2 years, kids born after 1990 have made a drastic shift. It used to be that half the time when they were connecting with friends, they do it on cell phone calls when it wasn't face-to-face. Half the time was by texting. In a survey that just came out a couple of weeks ago, it turns out the overwhelming majority prefer texting to cell phones. Okay? And that comes to the next 2 points I want to make. So the next point I want to make is about email voice. You know what email voice is? What does this have to do with connection? Email voice is you're talking to a friend or you're talking to a colleague or somebody you're dating, and you notice that they're there and they're not there. Why? Because you don't really have their attention. It's email voice. They're checking their email while they're talking to you. Okay? It's not that full attention. And you know how you feel when you're talking to somebody and it's their email voice on. You feel like they're not fully present. This Shabbos is Parshas Chodesh. One of the main lessons of Parshas Chodesh is the lessons about the sanctity of time and the importance of understanding the sanctity of time. And one of the main lessons is the lesson of how important it is to understand that human interaction and connection is kamayim panim el panim kein leifa adam. In this beautiful mamar that Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz has on this week's Parsha, he talks about how in order to really connect with somebody, it has to be face-to-face. Moshe's Vayarba Sivlosam is face-to-face. And this is the second point I want to make. And he talks about how when Yaakov wants to really give a bracha to Yosef's two children, he needs to hold them because he can't see them, to experience them. We need the visual cortex to really connect. We can't connect as well through media. There's something called mirror neurons. I was explaining this to the women last Tuesday night. I'll explain it to you. Because I think it's fascinating and it's important. Here's what mirror neurons are. I'm talking to you like this. So when I go like this, if you had a picture of my brain, like one of those kind of pictures, you would see that a specific motor neuron is firing in my brain that's specifically assigned to going like this. Fine, not so interesting. What's fascinating is all of you who are looking at me, your brains are hardwired so that you too have a specific mirror neuron. And guess what that mirror neuron is going like when I go like this? That specific neuron is going like this. It's new research over the last 5 years. It means we're hardwired to be nosei ba'olam chavero. We're hardwired for empathy. We're hardwired for connection. But it's only with the vayar. It's only with the visual cortex. Now, I'm not saying you can't connect at all through texting with somebody you're very close to. But the primary connection has to be on face-to-face. And that leads me to my final point, which has to do with dating. Tonight was supposed to be more global, but I was also asked to talk about the dating components here. And I'll share with you just for a few minutes some of the new research on decision-making and the internet. And it's something that I'm sure that you've been up against, actually. Let me see. You know what happens to the brain? There's a part in the frontal prefrontal cortex, just where we put the shel rosh on every morning, that's in charge of making wise decisions. When we're on the internet, and when you're checking out various women on Facebook, okay, and trying to figure out, is this somebody worth going out with? That's the part of the brain that's lit up, in part. It's the part that has decision making. But here's what the research shows. The research shows is the more choice you have, the less satisfied you are with the choices that make. And as choice gets to be too much, your decision-making starts to get taken over by a different part of the brain. And part of the brain that doesn't think very clearly and that probably makes some foolish choices. There's such a thing as too much information, there's such a thing as information overload, and there's such a thing as just the basic knowledge that the more choices we have, the more likely we are to be unhappy with the choices that we make. So I told the Stern undergraduates last Tuesday night that when Listerine changed the number of choices and flavors in their brand from like 20-something down to 8, their sales tripled. Interesting, right? The less choice you have, the more the sales go up. We do better with less choice. Let me end then with, I guess, my final take-home messages and maybe a story, okay? We could do that? I don't remember if I told this story last week, and I apologize to those of you who might have heard this story, but it's my favorite internet story, okay? And that's the message I'll leave you with. So the bottom line messages, let's summarize. So message number one was the message of that it takes a toll on us if we don't figure out how to replace Pisur HaNefesh with Menuchas HaNefesh at least once a week. But also to be mindful about that during the day. Maybe you could shut your cell phones off when you're in the Beis Medrash. You know, I don't know if that's done, but it's not such a bad thing to just have that. I remember once years ago when cell phones first came out, I was asked to give a talk at the Torah Masorah conference. And as I was waiting to give my talk, Shmuel Kamenetsky was speaking, and he said, you know, he was talking about cell phones, which then were brand new. He says he doesn't allow cell phones in Philadelphia yeshiva. Because he says if a boy in the Philadelphia yeshiva has a cell phone, he's not a Talmud of the Philadelphia yeshiva. His body may be there, but he says your soul can't be there if you have a cell phone. Because you're always at the mercy of the call. Tremendous wisdom in that. Okay? This is many years ago at the beginning of that technology, and things change and times change. And I'm not saying that we could get rid of everything, but we have to think about and be thoughtful about this. So that's take-home message number one. Take-home message number two was the take-home message about the importance of understanding how this shapes our connections. Beware of email voice. Be present. The need to be present and to figure out a way to be present in our connections. Because otherwise, we have a lot of communication without connection. We have a lot of people who are sleeping with cell phones under their pillows so that they could find out very important information like, hey, I'm just seeing if you're awake. Okay? We could live without such information. And the final thing is just knowing that in dating, we have to look at what really matters. We're going to hear much more about this from Rav Willig in terms of his wisdom on this, but we have to look at what matters. And I'll end with a story. Anybody hear the story? Story about the three questions, the Tolstoy short story about the three questions okay. Probably not, but with apologies to those of you who have heard it. I went to pay a shiva visit a few years ago to a good friend who's a physician, whose father was nifter after having a wonderful, wonderful career in the rabbinate. He was a wonderful pastoral rabbi, a wonderful Talmud Chacham. He had gotten a smicha here many, many years ago and was a wonderful, wonderful man. I knew him and always admired him. I'm sitting down at the shiva visit, and into the room walks a distinguished-looking man. He didn't look like the typical shiva visitor. It turns out later that this was a non-Jew who had never paid a shiva visit before, condolence call before. And my friend, who's a doctor, wants to like get up to show him respect. He can't believe that this man's there, because this man is the leading cardiothoracic surgeon on the East Coast, and maybe even in the United States. People come from all over the world to have surgery with this very, very prominent bypass surgeon. Nobody knows why the man is there, especially my friend. And the man says, look, I don't know what the protocol is for a condolence call. I don't even know what I should do. But when I heard your father died, I felt that I owe him my life, and I had to come here. Everybody's listening. And here's the story he said, and it's the final image I want to leave you with, okay? Story goes like this. Number of years earlier, this doctor was doing surgery in his operating room not too far from here in Manhattan. And his cell phone rings. Even there, cell phones go off. And he gets a call that his younger brother, a 40-year-old man who had never been sick a day in his life, had suddenly died. Okay? He shattered. Because here he's realizing that he somehow missed it. He had no way of knowing. His brother was never sick a day in his life, but after taking bereavement leave, he tries to go back to the hospital shop. He can't. With every stitch, he realizes that I failed my brother, I failed my brother, I failed my brother. I'm saving the lives of men well over twice his age. As karma chalona tata. I didn't take care of my own backyard. This is terrible. He gets more and more depressed, and finally he can't take it anymore, and he retires. Not a good idea. My father, who's a retired rabbi, says the toughest thing about retirement is he misses the vacations. Retirement isn't necessarily an answer. And now he really gets depressed. He's going to psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, nothing's helping. Finally, he remembers that 10 years earlier, he had done bypass surgery on a holy rabbi, a holy spiritual man who he just felt must have some wisdom. He felt very connected to this man. It's my friend's father, the man who he's sitting Shiva, my friend's sitting Shiva for. And he figures, look, I'm not Jewish, but maybe this rabbi will talk to me. After all, I helped him out when he needed bypass surgery. And he calls the rabbi. He says, can I come talk to you? And the rabbi says, of course, you saved my life. What kind of question? And he goes and he meets with the rabbi. And the rabbi says to him, he says, every human being has a soul that's lit up by a spark. Every human being has a spark. I just remembered I told this story at the Kollel in Marsha, right? Every human being has a soul that's lit up by a spark. He says, you lost your spark. You lost your spark. You have to re-find it. I can't tell you what it is. You have to find it. What is it? You have to find it for yourself. Why don't you go read books during the week? You're retired now. Come and meet with me once a week. We'll go over what you learned from the week, and maybe you'll find the answer for yourself that way. Doctor loves this. And he goes for regular meetings with the rabbi, and nothing's really changing until about 3 months into the process. He comes and he says, Rabbi, I think I have the answer. It's a Tolstoy short story that has as its end the lesson that when you have somebody in front of you, you have to ask three questions. Whenever you have somebody in front of you, question number one is you ask yourself, what's the most important time? The answer is, we know, what's the most important time? Lo ashave masai, not now when, now. Question number two, what's the most important thing when you have somebody in front of you? We know the answer to that, chesed, to do good, olam chesed ibana. Question number three is who's the most important person? And the answer to that is the person in front of you. This somehow reinvigorates this doctor's sense of purpose and sense of meaning. He goes back to the operating room. The hospital is more than happy to take him back. But now, if you traveled to his hospital and you were a fly in the wall when he does surgery, here's what you would see. If you want to operate in his operating room, this is what they do. The whole OR team forms a circle. They hold hands. The anesthesiologist, the nurse clinician, the surgery fellows, and he screams out, what's the most important time? Everybody has to scream out, now. What's the most important thing? Do good. Who's the most important person? The person in front of us, let's operate. And that's, I think, the bottom line take-home message, right? The bottom line take-home message is the message of being present. The message of looking at somebody, being there, and not having the pizur hanefesh, not having the distraction. And that's, I think, the introduction to our next two speakers. I think Charlie's going to introduce them. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you. I'd like to take it down to a level that maybe is practical in that I want to ask the doctor a question, in that I know for myself there are certain relations that I have where I have to always be constantly checking in, maybe parents and whatnot, just making sure that I'm okay at all times. So the question I have for the doctor is, how do you balance that? How do you balance the value of the text and the email that allows you to touch base with people, and then at the same time, not allow it to turn into a mile long and an inch deep?
Right. So look, it's interesting. I was in Silicon Valley about a year ago, and one of the talks I gave there was is this on? No. Okay. One of the talks I gave there was a talk to just a group of people who are literally living in the shadow of the Silicon Valley. This is in a local day school there, the Oakland Hebrew Day School. And one of the teachers there, who's an older woman, said that she grew up in a neighborhood surrounded by one of the magnificent redwood forests there. She said her summers, she and her friends would go out, spend the day barefoot, just roaming around the redwood forest, laying down, looking at the trees, looking at nature. And they disappear like 10 o'clock in the morning. They come back as soon as sun was setting. And she says, we've lost that sense of just being present. And the women in the audience, it was mostly mothers, were horrified. They said, but how did your mothers know whether or not you were okay? How did you survive? How did they survive not knowing that you were checking in with them on a regular basis? This was way before the invention of cell phones. And that was exactly the point. The point is we've reset our default setting about what it takes to feel reassured. I don't know that it's that necessary. Sure, for Kibbutz Ave, and we have to check in on a regular basis. But I'm telling you, that doesn't take. We all know texting is cheap. We all know that texting a parent or texting a friend or texting even a woman you're going out with, it's cheap. It's cheap. It's not nearly as valuable as the face-to-face of going and being with them. We need to kind of evaluate that. Of course, there's positives to this, but it can't be the easier. It needs to be the tougher. Anyway.
One point that we're going to move on. Thank you, Doctor. Yeah. There's one thing, you know, I got married a little bit before the internet. It was like, you know, just when before it hit. And so something that happened to us, I didn't realize was happening now, but I think it's important that I wanted to address. In life, college, growing up, high school, college, the beginning of your life, is a period of time where you're learning how to do things. You're stumbling, falling, and trying. One of the hardest things to do, I find, is breaking up with somebody. It's hard. Telling somebody something they don't want to hear is hard because you have to deal with it. It's hard when especially if it's a girl, because, you know, you hate doing that. It's hard when you have to, when you get into the business world and deals, it's hard when you have to sort of do something in that area. But saying things that people don't like, breaking up with a chavrusa, very difficult. I'm sure it's a spiel of yours. It's at one point. When saying something that bothers somebody else is very hard. And so what happens sometimes, this is when I was married, is if you have to break up with somebody, you have to suck it up, and it hurt like crazy, and you got to come out of your comfort zone, and you got to just say it. You do it once and twice, and hopefully not more than that, but you ultimately learn how to have tough conversations. You learn how to have meaningful conversations. And it's a skill that doesn't go away. It builds you into a person that you're supposed to be. It builds you into the dad you're supposed to be. It builds you into the community leader you're supposed to be. And what happens sometimes is when you have the ability to use social media to hide behind that tough conversation, we say, what's the point? I'll just text it or email it. Game over. And what I'm hearing now for the first time, because we didn't have this, is the reliance on the internet to be the front to bad news. And what that does is, not only is it cheaper, what it does is it takes us away from being the people that we're supposed to be. And so one idea to think about, in addition to all the great things you've heard, is that the power of the internet, not just the ability for us to have sort of shallower relationships, but the ability for us to not grow as the individuals that we're supposed to be. This applies in relationships, and also now moving on to business. Because you know, and for those of you that are involved in trying, looking for jobs, the internet is extremely crucial, whether it's networking or knowledge or understanding things in business or learning. The internet is a very powerful tool for your careers. And the question for the next speaker is, how do you balance that? How do you balance when it's good and when it's not good? Because the ability to learn how to use internet for your careers could actually enhance, and hopefully not in any way, take you away from the careers you're supposed to have. So without further ado, I'd like to ask Dr. Nissenfeld to say a few words.
Thank you. Good evening. I've been asked, therefore, to talk about the implications of all of this for the business world. And what you will hear from me is that I will be building very much upon what Dr. Pelkovitz has talked about. There is no question that there is remarkable change going on. You saw the data there in terms of how widespread. It's hard to believe that 10 years ago there was no social media. The universe and the world has changed and the workplace has changed. The conclusion is that the pace of change is unprecedented. Technology adoption is shifting our behavior. It's shifting the behavior of consumers, of our personal lives, and it's shifting the behavior in the workplace. That's a tremendous opportunity. It's also a tremendous challenge. It is not a trend. It is a fabric of everyday life. It's the way we're going to be doing business now. The implication is for retailers and for brands and for employees that those who embrace the change will gain competitive advantage. So for people going to the workplace, the opportunity there is embracing this change and you will have competitive advantage. The question is, what do we mean? What do we mean by embrace the change and what are the pitfalls in the workplace? As I was preparing for the talk, I saw an article by McKinsey and Company, which is one of the outstanding business consulting firms. And they noted that email, Twitter, Facebook, blog, Blackberries, new social media are increasingly shaping the behavior, if not taking over the behavior, of the younger employees in the workplace who are logging on at work, emailing from the BlackBerry on weekends and 24/7. I'd like to talk about the implications from two concepts that we use in the business world. We talk about efficiency and effectiveness. When we talk about efficiency, we talk about using resources, using your time wisely from a cost perspective. That is key to success in business. When we talk about effectiveness, we talk about the quality, making the right decisions. Hi, Shlomi, how are you? Good to see you. In the workplace, on the positive side, the access to emerging technologies, the web, instant messaging, provide boundless opportunities for knowledge and communication. Yeah, I'm not that old a guy, but I'm telling you, when I was your age, it's unbelievable what we didn't have that you have now going into the workplace in terms of access to knowledge, access to communication, access to information. It is changing the nature of businesses. At the Kukin Lecture Series that we do in the business school 2 weeks ago, a CEO of a global architecture firm talked about how he personally uses Twitter, Facebook, blogs to connect in a more meaningful and impactful way with his customers. And he's using that to build stronger client relationships than he ever had before. Managers and their employees can communicate with each other on an ongoing basis, and that's the good news. Communications is critical to successful performance at work for individuals and for performance. But the bad news is that businesses and workers and researchers of the business are all agreeing that we are dealing with, ladies and gentlemen, information overload. The tools of the digital age can, but don't necessarily lead to better relationships, more effective communications, productivity, and success. So when we talk about effectiveness from Management 101, or if you're at SciSims, Management 1020, it's about making the right decisions. What we see increasing in the workplace is that there is ineffective decision-making, ineffective choice of communication modality. In the workplace, you have the issue, do we communicate electronically, in person, digitally, or direct? Electronic obviously provides wonderful opportunities in terms of quick, permanent, immediate, ongoing, interactive. The landmine is that it can be too quick and too casual and perhaps too permanent. A colleague of mine today at work sent an email. He thought he was responding to a certain people. He didn't realize he was responding to all, in which he was criticizing the performance of someone who got that email. Now, I would like to kind of snicker and laugh at him, but I've been in that situation. And the danger is all of us can be in that situation. We have tremendous capability, but we have to think about how we use these tools. Most notoriously, such companies and executives of companies like, here's a rogues gallery for you, Enron, Tyco, WorldCom, Bear Stearns, and others were actually convicted of misdeeds, aided and abetted by their very own use of their very own email. One speaker we had was a senior executive from Bear Stearns, who was fired from Bear Stearns after he, without much thinking, and this is a senior person, not a 21-year-old yeshiva guy, this is a Gavir, a long in life, who somehow thought it was a good idea to share his reflections about what was going on in the business in his own personal blog. Well, the board begged to differ with him and said, what are you doing? He was out, his career was over. There's an emerging issue in companies in terms of how to govern social media. Some of you may have seen the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago talk about the New York City Ballet, which is one of the first companies to actually try to institute policy guidelines for its employees, because it occurred to them that the employees complaining, griping, inappropriate joking on the social media was detrimental to the organization. And they're negotiating a social media policy. This is a trend that is in evolution. We don't know where this is going. There was a case recently, an EMS technician, I think in Cleveland, who was given a bad performance review by their boss, and she proceeded to Facebook to attack her boss, and they proceeded to fire her. She brought the case to court, went up to the Supreme Court, and guess what? She actually won. They protected. So there are tremendous unclear, I think, guidelines in terms of how the court's going to do this. But I have to tell you, as somebody who consults to business and to individuals in business, I don't think it's a great career move to share your thoughts about your boss, potentially on Facebook. People are not thinking. It amazes me that people that have intelligence are so consumed and seduced by the technology that they lose their judgment. If not managed correctly, the over-reliance on technology for communications, in the absence of the personal, which Dr. Pelkovitz talked about, can lead to misunderstanding, deterioration of discussions in the workplace without absolutely any need. When offered a phone call or direct conversation or, God forbid, actually talking to the person in person, an actual meeting, can settle the whole matter in a short time. Instead of endless email exchanges that we all get caught up in, including myself, that in the end can be more time-consuming and ineffective. Over-reliance on technology for communications, according to some researchers, can leave employees clueless as to organizational issues and politics, cause them to drop out of the grapevine. The grapevine is an important source of knowing and understanding an organization. If you're out of the grapevine, you can miss the informal communications that are critical elements to successful business relationships. Person-to-person communication promotes feedback. It allows for focus on the nonverbal cues that are so important. An emerging area to watch would be the impact of this new technology on what the Harvard researcher Daniel Goleman has called emotional intelligence. Goleman describes emotional intelligence as the capacity that we have to recognize our own feelings and those of others, for motivating others, for managing emotions well in ourselves and our relationships. When people are asked to define what a great business leader is, sometimes people often emphasize intelligence, toughness, vision. What's often left off are those softer things, the more personal qualities, but numerous studies by Goleman and others have shown that these softer things, the personal qualities, are essential to success in business and in leadership. Although a certain degree of analytical and technical skill are important and are minimum requirements, what we call emotional intelligence may be the key attribute that distinguishes between great leaders, great performers in the workplace, and those who are merely adequate in their performance. Some of you may have seen, I think the Times had it last week, Google did a study of their own organization. What makes a great leader at Google? And everybody expected they would be dazzled by technical wizardry. What they found was that Google came out consistent with what Goldman talks about in many other studies. What they found that the Google employees valued most were bosses who made time for one-on-one meetings. Low Aliyah BlackBerry, low Aliyah Twitter, but in person. And they helped their colleagues by showing an interest in their lives and in their careers. The quote that I found interesting was, most important was making that time, connection, and being personally accessible in Google. So success as a leader in business is not only about data and information and instant communication. Those things are nice, they're helpful, they're tremendous resources. It's also about relationships, just as Dr. Felsen spoke about earlier. Goldman talks about the importance of empathy, communication, social awareness, relationship management. Do you sense others' feelings and perspectives and take that into consideration? Can you read the emotional concerns of others? Can you assess their needs, their development needs? Can you inspire and guide individuals? Do you have an impact on others? Can you deal with conflict? Can you work with others towards a shared goal, teamwork, collaboration? All those are essential elements of emotional intelligence and traits that are key to success in the workplace and in life. Exclusive or over-reliance on technology can diminish our sensitivity towards and our development and our use of those kinds of traits. It can reduce our ability to have a strong culture, to have a strong working relationships, to create mutually supportive atmosphere of trust and cooperativeness that the great companies have. Let me talk about efficiency. Business workers and researchers are seeing widespread signs of overload and inefficiency. On the negative side, emails, IMs, distractions on the web, if not disciplined, can lead to grossly inefficient performance work. And there's a lot of research showing that there is tremendous inefficiency already coming about as workers adjust to this new world. A recent survey showed that more than half of the workers surveyed say that digital distractions hurt their productivity and they're working more hours as a result. That's, as we say in the business world, a shanda. Another survey of white-collar workers shows that half of them agree, quote, that they're near their breaking point if they have to manage any more information. Workers are drowning in a sea of information. What's the impact? Bottom line. One estimate says workers are losing 25 to 30% of their time to information overload. One estimate says it's costing the American economy $1 billion a year because we're not managing it effectively. We're not embracing it effectively. It is of such concern in the business world that a consortium of business leaders was created to dedicated to fighting the problem, to create what they call the Information Overload Research Group that is working with companies to identify ways to embrace technology without being swamped by it in the workplace. We're creating more and more technology that allows us to interrupt each other incessantly in the workplace. One researcher found that the average knowledge worker switches tasks every 3 minutes. Now, it is not true that by multitasking you get more done. In fact, the lack of time to absorb things, to reflect on things, hinders the ability for creativity. The cost of switching attention from one task to another leads to a reduction in productivity. Companies are responding in different ways now to respond to this challenge. So, for example, IBM carves out Think Friday. Quiet time for their employees, for innovation, collaboration. There are no emails and no text messaging allowed. Google encourages their engineers not to check their email during a designated hour on certain days. Intel is training its workers to use their emails more efficiently and effectively. So, as technology enables more and more information, workers need to develop the strategies, the tools, and the skills to cope and deal with this potential overload. To wrap up, let me share with you the 10 top secrets to success in dealing with the digital world and information overload. Number 10, you're going to go down. Number 10, take charge of the technology. Do not let gadgets and technology decide what you're doing. Be aware, by the way, of the message that it sends. When you sit in a meeting, I'm sure nobody here, but there are students I've heard that will actually sit in class on the BlackBerry. And we all do it in meetings. It's evident. People know you're doing it. It sends a certain message of disrespect to your colleagues. Number 9, step away from the inbox. One study shows that 70% of emails are read within 6 seconds. Is that good? Or maybe it's not so good. It's not necessary. Set a schedule for checking the email. It should not control your life. You control the emails. Number 8, manage the settings, pop-ups, news reports. Keep them under control. Number 7, escape. Carve time away from the desks and the gadgets. Management by walking around, as we talk about in the workplace. Connecting with people in person still works, and you need that to recharge your creative juices in the workplace. Number 6, write smarter. Before you hit that press button, as my unfortunate colleague did today, think about what you're sending and to whom, and be considerate of others. Number 5, ease up on the reply all. The Nielsen company eliminated this function. It's often unneeded and inefficient. It is not necessary to include the universe in every message that you have. Number 4, ditch the etiquette book. You do not have to acknowledge every email. As they say in Harvard Business School, ain't so. It goes on forever. Number 3, be discreet when you're using emails for sensitive issues. Think before hitting the send button. Take a breath and sleep on it. Number 2, there are certain things to use BlackBerry for and there are certain things not to use BlackBerry for. Do not use BlackBerry to close a deal in the workplace or in life. Number 1, the top solution. Don't be seduced by the technology. Don't be lazy. Choose the right tools. Don't ignore the value of the personal contact. Picking up the phone, talking directly to deal with more complex, nuanced, conflict-laden situations and challenges. Use a broad range of communication, media, and modality to capitalize on the advantages of each. In person, phone, electronic, and there's much research that shows, those of you in my class can talk about it, that the great leaders in the business world are those that have flexible leadership styles for the right context. And that's what the communication tools provide us. They provide us that kind of flexibility. Use it for the right way. Leverage the new digital universe. Don't lose track of the personal element. Let me end with the following words from a wise social critic, perhaps a business guru. It was not in the Harvard Business Review. And the quote is, "Hamakom yatzi leini mipizur ha-nefesh." Dr. Pelkowitz talked about it before. This is from Chovos HaLevavos and the quote from Rabbeinu Bachya. And, of course, what it says, may HaKadosh Baruch Hu save us from dispersion, the scattered spirit and soul. It was on target then, it's on target now, more than ever. It's about our ability to focus on what's important, whether in our everyday life, dating, or in our business world. In the workplace, the digital revolution should be embraced to enable and ennoble our performance. My goodness is that. But not to distract or divert our attention, focus, and relationships.
Thank you, Doctor. What we're going to do for the rest is, in a minute, we're going to have Willick speak, and then afterwards we're going to open up the questions. Is there sheets in front of you if you want to, after the rabbi speaks, pass them up, and I can read them if anyone has questions they want to just share with the public, even better. Let me just add one note to Dr. Nussbaum's presentation. I probably interviewed close to 1,000 people in the various law firms and companies that I've worked for, and I can tell you the following. Because you guys are coming up through the ranks in terms of finding jobs, what that means in terms of technology. I look for really one thing, and if you manage to do this, you come across, I think, different than the rest. I look for somebody who is in control of technology and not vice versa. Many times I'm sitting in a meeting, and I don't know what is flying, And I pretend like I do. I'm like, I agree completely. I'm like, I gotta go to the bathroom, I'll be right back. I go, Google it, I come right back, I know everything. And people that are older than me have no idea that you can do this so quickly. And they're so impressed, which is great. And you have that option. When you're dealing with people that are young, they know how to do this stuff, and you want them around because they know how to get stuff quickly. They know how to use the internet for your benefit. That's very powerful. LinkedIn is very powerful. If you know how to make a contact with somebody and know how to get one degree away and make a real call as opposed to a cold call, if you know how to use technology to further your careers, it's amazing. Do it. However, when, like Dr. Nissenfeld mentioned, many times people bring back work and you can tell that they can't pay attention for more than 30 seconds, bad news. That's like, you know, that's the alarm bell. Because what happens is when there's so much going on, you can't sit down for 30 seconds and actually read what you gotta do or focus on task at hand. And it doesn't start at your desk, it starts here. If you can't focus at task at hand because of email to study, you can't focus at task at hand when you're sitting at your job. It doesn't start there. And what happens is, especially if you're a summer intern, you bring back bad work. And we can tell. And when there's 7,000 applicants, there's no like, let me work with you. It's next one. Because there's no time. And so my 2 cents here, for whatever it's worth, is technology is a very good friend of yours. But if it begins to take away your brain functionality, and you can't think analytically, and you can't actually find problems, you don't add value. And somebody else will. So use it for your benefit. Control it. Because if you know how, you can be very powerful, but don't let it control you. Moving on. Acharon acharon chaviv to the Rav, Rabbi Willick, to share words of Torah, Halacha, Hashkafa, and inspiration.
Thank you very much. The hour is late. You'll hear almost no Torah, almost no Halacha, except that half Shabbos is not allowed in case it's a Yeah, those who are trying to give in, that's not allowed. Perhaps Hashkafa, and I hope some advice from someone who is old enough to have a completely different perspective. Let's start with the dating component. I'll start with a story. A young lady, for the first time, comes to meet her prospective future in-laws. The deal's already done, it's just a matter of formality. When the evening is over, the relationship comes to an end. What went wrong? One thing. Young lady came into the house, table, people sitting around, talking, probably some good food, and they notice that, you know, that was it. They told their son, you cannot marry this woman. And it was just over. Turn the blasted thing off. You're going to get married and go into the yichud room, and then they're going to get a text and go, what is this? Have you lost it completely? But that's only taken to the absurd. If you're on a date, turn it off. Focus on the, I'm speaking to a male audience, on the woman in front of you. You heard so eloquently from Dr. Polkowitz about looking. Don't be distracted. These are basic lessons, fundamental lessons. Good advice. To move to a slightly different angle with respect to the dating, dating is an attempt to establish the most significant, profound relationship that you'll ever have. It must be maintained in privacy. Tzinius is just you and this woman. That's it. It's nobody else's business. This lesson has been lost in the modern era. Lost completely. I'll tell another story. When I proposed to my wife, I took her to a boardwalk, not far from where Dr. Pelkowitz and my wife grew up, Far Rockaway. We sat down, looking out at the Atlantic Ocean. And thankfully she said yes. And we went home to her parents, and then with my parents. Shalom. That was it. That's it. No more. Finished. The next morning we made some phone calls. Today, it's the absolute opposite. First of all, even before this new technology, was this, you know, you have to get engaged in some kind of a mega event. African safari, a helicopter, at the very least a stretch limo, at the very least. That was bad enough. I think it's unhealthy. What's happened much worse in recent years is with the new technology, it spins out of control. Okay, the whole world has to know about it. There's something called only simchas. I know about that. And yes, some simchas in my family, the more recent ones, were on, quote, only simchas. Fine. But that happened afterwards. Couple got engaged, quietly, private moment, came to the parents' home, made a few calls, got announced, we got around, okay, fine. Now, from what I understand, and what they say, a picture's worth 1,000 words, what's a video worth? Many thousands. The people are getting engaged on video. I'm not sure what the exact technology is called. YouTube is called Facebook. I'm a complete ignoramus of all these things. But when someone shows me a screen which has a picture of people getting engaged, how does anyone know about it? What are they doing there? What are they doing there? And why must it be broadcast to the entire world in instant time? So that every grimace and every facial motion is to the, what happened to the one-on-one relationship? It's an outrage. It takes away from the holiness of the moment. Chazal tell us that we perform acts of kindness, we're supposed to do it b'tzina, as the Rabbi Shalom did it. And yes, there are exceptions. We have weddings. I'm not saying you should get pshut elope. That's not what I'm saying. Or chas v'shalom. The wedding, yes. I'm even in favor of videos of weddings, not like some of my other rabbinic colleagues. But everything in proper measure. You lose complete proportion, unfortunately. For now, I'm going to say something which I'm sure you'll have difficulty relating to. But I'm really only echoing my colleagues. When cell phones started in the 90s, correct? Is that correct? Earlier? 80s, you mean? But they became more popularized somewhere in the 90s, whatever it was. So, I'm a rabbi in a shul, as we heard. And the president approached me and says, Rabbi, we want to buy you a cell phone, we'll pay for it. Famous president. I said, no, thank you. I viewed the cell phone as a leash. A leash. L-E-A-S-H. We have you on a leash. Now, in some professions, I'm not speaking to the business world, they have you on a leash. They have you on, now it's up to a BlackBerry, you have to answer within 2 minutes. 24/7, or you lose your job. We heard from the professionals and how that impacts on productivity, etc. But from my perspective, as a rabbi in a shul, I felt, and I still feel, because I still do not have a cell phone, I kid you not, I have nothing in my pocket. There's no cell phone on me. that in order for someone to be productive, you have to be able to focus. If I'm carrying a cell phone, I am, as we heard, from the professionals, not from the rabbanim. I'm distracted. When I open a Gemara, I do not want to be distracted. I want to be able to focus on what the Gemara says, and then Rashi, and then Tosfos, etc. I do not want to be distracted. It's not even enough to disregard the ring or the vibrate. I don't want it. I want no part of it. The same, Rabbi, in your profession, you have to know case, emergency, who knows what, alavaya, the worst case scenario. So what? What did we do before cell phones? What did we do? The same thing they do for me now. They used to call the office in the yeshiva, they send someone to get me. That's all. So when the last such incident happened when I was in yeshiva, instead of calling the office and having someone get me, aside from that, they called 5 yeshiva guys on their cell phones and they all came to get me. Because they didn't have their cell phones off. How do you focus if you're distracted? I'm not speaking from the profession of, PhD in psychology or in business. A plain individual who likes to master the halacha, the Torah. We have information overload too. Absolutely. Now we have Bar Ilan, 18. You know, you see everything. If you don't use your head, you'll just be a parrot. You don't understand a thing. Nothing. Zero. The analytical skills are much more important than all this knowledge. Yeah, you have to have basic knowledge. We know that. The Gemara tells us you have to have basic knowledge. We can't analyze air. But once you have a basic knowledge, and yes, not opposed to accessing things with various tools, whatever they may be, search engines, but your day, your time in Beis Medrash, your time learning, has to be focused on analytical skills, just in reading the text. There's no substitute. You heard from the professionals that reading on the screen is not the same as reading a book. How much more so they're not the same? The things are popping up and things are vibrating and clinging. I just saw for the first time yesterday a Kol Kore written by many, many distinguished Rabbanim in Israel and in America prohibiting having cell phones on in shul. Shul. People come to shul with their cell phones on. Thank God 99% of them don't ring. But you could hear them vibrate. What are those pings every once in a while? I don't know what it means. You got a message or something? Bing! Bing! Whatever it may be, in the middle of the shul, Mishra's bing! So the person's a tzaddik, it doesn't reach into his pocket. Why must I hear his ping? Turn it off! Turn it off. If you don't have the wisdom to turn it off in the Beis Medrash, you will lack future wisdom as a result. But at least have the propriety to turn it off in the shul. As I said before, turn it off on the date. If you don't turn it off, as we heard before, it's mastering you. I spoke at a school, also not that far from our the old hunting grounds in Far Rockaway. I was asked to speak there last year, I think it was before Shavuos, a major feeder school to our own yeshiva. And I said, they didn't listen to me, but I said, and they should still listen to me, that they should do what they do in certain high schools, which is, you come into the school, everybody has a cell phone now. Why? But okay. Check it at the door. At the door. Here's my cell phone. I don't need it in the school. The school has a telephone. Emergency, they call the office and they did. When I was in high school. Oh my God. Yes, we had telephones then. Yes, we did. After Alexander Graham Bell. Not that much after that. Check it at the door. Every boy at school comes in, you know, and he has a chill. He puts a chill in a little cubicle. Put this, should be in there. Place in a little cubicle for your cell phone. That's it. You need it in an emergency. There's a guard who's sitting in front. Everyone's well, now the guard, security guard, he's watching the drill, he's watching your cell phone. You need it. You want to get it out for lunch hour or whatever, recess. Okay. Put it back. Why must teachers in Rabbein have to fight with their students about inappropriate cell phones in class? It's an outrage. It's an outrage. It diminishes every single teacher and Rebbe in our yeshiva system. It's his job to be the disciplinarian of this area. It's the school's job. You people are already mature adults. We finished high school. We're in Israel for a year or two. You or yeah. But high school boys, we all know we're immature. Such a percentage that are texting on Shabbos. Let me verify what Dr. Pelkovitz said. This past summer in Kiev, our shop, and yes, that was a wonderful story the first time and the second time. And I know the persons who were being discussed. I speak there once every summer on Shabbos Chazon to give a shmooze. So I always ask the mechanchim in school, in camp, when we're teaching in different schools, what is the number one problem I should talk about? I asked the mechanchim, some of you know Horashak, and guess who I'm talking about, who taught in DRS, MTA, Frisch, Ramaz, the fifth escaped, maybe it was TABC, one of the schools, that we know those schools, and each one of the five independently told me the same answer, texting and jobs. Five people asked separately, the five gave the same answer. So whoever thinks that your data is incorrect is just not looking at the reality. It's a tragedy. And I spoke that time on Shabbos Chazon, and I said speaking to the staff, because if you staff members, men and women, do not energize your students, campers, to have a more positive outlook on Shabbos, they'll be texting. Dr. Talbot beats me. He's talking about today's news. I'm telling from yesterday. I was at a meeting of the Orthodox Forum across the street. I have a very distinguished mechutin from Los Angeles, Rabbi Adlesley Shlita, who's an expert in these things. And he gave a paper, he hands on the paper. It's about the new technology and how it affects the various branches of Orthodoxy, right, left, and center. And he hands, that the right is not equipped, they prohibit it. This story, I think Rabbi Taklos will probably confirm. Rabbi Solomon from Lakewood was taken around in a car after they had prohibited the use of the internet at the home, only in the office. But they have ways of detecting it from the car. Went up and down every single block in the heart of his Lakewood, and there was internet everywhere. So banning it doesn't work even in Lakewood. So it's not going to work for us. But Rabbi Adlesley concluded, at the end of the day, they will still have a certain measure of respect for authority figures, and they'll survive. But the center and left face a much more difficult challenge, losing it completely. What do you say, 40% of yeshiva students, not public school students, are texting on Shabbos? What does that say? I had a conversation at that meeting across the street yesterday with someone sitting right next to me. I said, this is terrible. And I gave my proposal of checking the cell phones at the door. He said to me, it won't work. I said, why won't it work? You may be able to check at the door, you'll become irrelevant. Because if you're not holding your cell phone, so everything's irrelevant. I said, my dear friend, I know what you're saying. It's absolute surrender. Surrender. The administration surrendering to the will of the students. My Rebbe used to teach us to surrender to the will of the Almighty. And the will of the Almighty supposed to be given over by Torah authority figures? And if they say, not only quoting halachic sources and common sense, but quoting experts like these, tops in their field, that the cell phone takes away your concentration, is going to take away from your ability to fulfill the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And yes, even in secular studies, we say it disturbs, it distracts, it is an impediment to proper education. Leave it at the door. If you concede that that makes you irrelevant, you've surrendered before the first shot. That was my response. When I came home, I told my wife the story. She said, "You're in another world." She knows I don't have a cell phone. And that's how much more so I don't relate to all these other, I can't even pronounce all the names. To which I responded, "Perhaps. But I feel the responsibility to say what is right from my perspective. Everyone can feel free to ignore it completely. I'm not saying how you should conduct yourself in the business world. You have an expert. I'm speaking from my world. The world of here. What are you here for? To become a Talmid Chacham. To become a Yirei Shamayim. As well as to become educated for a career, etc. From my perspective, turn it off. And not only in the Beis Medrash, in Shul, but from my perspective, the dating process is subsumed under the critical mandate of how to become a Ben Torah. Can't be a Ben Torah without a proper wife. And if it distracts you from your dating, as we've heard, and as I can document from my stories, turn it off. You want to call it Das Torah? I'm not insulted. I don't care what you want to call it. I conclude, turn it off.
Okay, let's finish up in the last portion of the night. If anyone has cards they want to pass up, we're going to take questions. If anyone has questions in the audience, they want to answer that a card. Anyone have any questions for any of the panelists? Yeah. Just make sure it's loud so everyone hears my question.
Easy as it is possible to go back and forth.